particular interest in them. When you sense that they are thinking about you, that is the time to hit them with your first letter. Any desire you express for them will come as a surprise. Their vanity will be tickled, and they will want more. Now, make your letters frequent. In fact, more frequent than your personal appearances. This will give them the time and space to idealize you, which would be more difficult if you were always in their face. After they have fallen under your spell, you can always take a step back, making the letters fewer. Let them think you're losing interest, and they will be hungry for more. Design your letters as homages to your targets. Make everything you write come back to them, as if they were all you could think about, a delirious effect. If you tell an anecdote, make it somehow relate to them. Your correspondence is a kind of mirror you are holding up to them. They get to see themselves reflected through your desire. If for some reason they don't like you, write to them as if they did. Remember, the tone of your letters is what will get under their skin. If your language is elevated, poetic, creative in its praise, it will infect them despite themselves. Never argue, never defend yourself, never accuse them of being heartless. That would ruin the spell. A letter can suggest emotion by seeming disordered, rambling from one subject to another. Clearly, it's hard for you to think. Your love has unhinged you. Disordered thoughts are exciting thoughts. Do not waste time on real information. Focus on feelings and sensations, using expressions that are ripe with connotation. Plant ideas by dropping hints, writing suggestively without explaining yourself. Never lecture, never seem intellectual or superior. You'll only make yourself pompous, which is deadly. Far better to speak colloquially, though with a poetic edge to lift the language above the commonplace. Do not become sentimental. It's tiring and too direct. Better to suggest the effect your target has on you than to gush about how you feel. Stay vague and ambiguous, allowing the reader the space to imagine and fantasize. The goal of your writing is not to express yourself, but to create emotion in the reader, spreading confusion and desire. You will know that your letters are having the proper effect when your targets come to mirror your thoughts, repeating words you wrote, whether in their own letters or in person. This is the time to move to the more physical and erotic. Use language that quivers with sexual connotation, or better still, suggest sexuality by making your letters shorter, more frequent, and even more disordered than before. There is nothing more erotic than the short, abrupt note. Your thoughts are unfinished. They can only be completed by the other person. Keys to seduction. We rarely think before we talk. It's human nature to say the first thing that comes into our head, and usually what comes first is something about ourselves. We primarily use words to express our own feelings, ideas, and opinions, also to complain and to argue. This is because we are generally self-absorbed. The person who interests us most is our own self. To a certain extent, this is inevitable, and through much of our lives, there's nothing much wrong with it. We can function quite well this way. In seduction, however, it limits our potential. You cannot seduce without an ability to get outside your own skin and inside another person's, piercing their psychology. The key to seductive language is not the words you utter or your seductive tone of voice. It's a radical shift in perspective and habit. You have to stop saying the first thing that comes to your mind. You have to control the urge to prattle and vent your opinions. The key is to see words as a tool not for communicating true thoughts and feelings, but for confusing, delighting, and intoxicating. The difference between normal language and seductive language is like the difference between noise and music. Our normal language is like noise. People may half listen to us as we go on about ourselves, but just as often, their thoughts are a million miles away. Every now and then their ears prick up when something we say touches on them, but this lasts only until we return to yet another story about ourselves. As early as childhood, we learn to tune out this kind of noise, particularly when it comes from our parents. Music, on the other hand, is seductive and gets under our skin. It is intended for pleasure. A melody or rhythm stays in our blood for days after we've heard it, altering our moods and emotions, relaxing or exciting us. To make music instead of noise, you must say things that please, things that relate to people's lives, that touch their vanity. If they have many problems, you can produce the same effect by distracting them, focusing their attention away from themselves by saying things that are witty and entertaining, or that make the future seem bright and hopeful. Promises and flattery are music to anyone's ears. This is language designed to move people and lower their resistance. It is language designed for them, not directed at them. The Italian writer Gabriele D'Annunzio was physically unattractive, yet women could not resist him. Even those who knew of his Don Juan reputation and disliked him for it, the actress Eleanor Duse and the dancer Isadora Duncan, for instance, fell under his spell. The secret was the flow of words in which he enveloped a woman. His voice was musical, his language poetic, and most devastating of all, he knew how to flatter. His flatter was aimed precisely at a woman's weaknesses, the areas where she needed validation. A woman was beautiful, yet lacked confidence in her own wit and intelligence. He made sure to say that he was bewitched not by her beauty, but by her mind. He might compare her to a heroine of literature, or to a carefully chosen mythological figure. Talking to him, her ego would double in size. Flattery is seductive language in its purest form. Its purpose is not to express a truth or a real feeling, but only to create an effect on the recipient. Like D'Annunzio, learn to aim your flattery directly at a person's insecurities. For instance, if a man is a fine actor and feels confident about his professional skills, to flatter him about his acting will have little effect, and may even accomplish the opposite. He could feel that he is above the need to have his ego stroked, and your flattery will seem to say otherwise. But let us say that this actor is an amateur musician or painter. He does this work on his own without professional support or publicity, and he's well aware that others make their living at it. Flattery of his artistic pretensions will go straight to his head and earn you double points. Learn to sniff out the parts of a person's ego that need validation. Make it a surprise, something no one else has thought to flatter before, something you can describe as a talent or positive quality that others have not noticed. Speak with a little tremor, as if your target's charms had overwhelmed you and made you emotional. Flattery can be a kind of verbal foreplay. Aphrodite's powers of seduction, which were said to come from the magnificent girdle she wore, involved a sweetness of language, a skill with the soft, flattering words that prepare the way for erotic thoughts. Insecurities and nagging self-doubts have a dampening effect on the libido. Make your targets feel secure and alluring through your flattering words, and their resistance will melt away. Sometimes, the most pleasant thing to hear is the promise of something wonderful, a vague but rosy future that is just around the corner. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in his public speeches, talked little about specific programs for dealing with the Depression. Instead, he used rousing rhetoric to paint a picture of America's glorious future. In the various legends of Don Juan, the great seducer would immediately focus women's attention on the future, a fantastic world to which he promised to whisk them off. Tailor your sweet words to your target's particular problems and fantasies. Promise something realizable, something possible, but do not make it too specific. You are inviting them to dream. If they're mired in dull routine, talk of adventure, preferably with you. Don't discuss how it will be accomplished. Speak as if it magically already existed, somewhere in the future. Lift people's thoughts into the clouds, and they will relax. Their defenses will come down, and it will be that much easier to maneuver and lead them astray. Your words become a kind of elevating drug. The most anti-seductive form of language is argument. How many silent enemies do we create by arguing? There is a superior way to get people to listen and be persuaded. Humor and a light touch. The 19th century English politician Benjamin Disraeli was a master at this game. In Parliament, to fail to reply to an accusation or slanderous comment was a deadly mistake. Silence meant the accuser was right. Yet to respond angrily to get into an argument was to look ugly and defensive. Disraeli used a different tactic. He stayed calm. When the time came to reply to an attack, he would slowly make his way to the speaker's table, pause, then utter a humorous or sarcastic retort. Everyone would laugh. Now that he had warmed people up, he would proceed to refute his enemy, still mixing in amusing comments, or perhaps he would simply move on to another subject, as if he were above it all. His humor took out the sting of any attack on him. Laughter and applause have a domino effect. Once your listeners have laughed, they are more likely to laugh again. In this light-hearted mood, they're also more apt to listen. A subtle touch and a bit of irony give you room to persuade them, move them to your side, mock your enemies. That is the seductive form of argument. Shortly after the murder of Julius Caesar, the head of the band of conspirators who had killed him, Brutus, addressed an angry mob. He tried to reason with the crowd, explaining that he had wanted to save the Roman Republic from dictatorship. The people were momentarily convinced. Yes, Brutus seemed a decent man. Then Mark Antony took the stage, and he in turn delivered a eulogy for Caesar. He seemed overwhelmed with emotion. He talked of his love for Caesar and of Caesar's love for the Roman people. He mentioned Caesar's will. The crowd clamored to hear it, but Antony said no, for if he read it, they would know how deeply Caesar had loved them, and how dastardly this murder was. The crowd again insisted he read the will. Instead, he held up Caesar's blood-stained cloak, noting its rents and tears. This was where Brutus had stabbed the great general, he said. Cassius had stabbed him here. Then finally he read the will, which told how much wealth Caesar had left to the Roman people. This was the coup de grace. The crowd turned against the conspirators and went off to lynch them. Antony was a clever man who knew how to stir a crowd. According to the Greek historian Plutarch, when he saw that his oratory had cast a spell over the people and that they were deeply stirred by his words, he began to introduce into his praises of Caesar a note of pity and of indignation at Caesar's fate. Seductive language aims at people's emotions, for emotional people are easier to deceive. Antony used various devices to stir the crowd, a tremor in his voice, a distraught and then an angry tone. An emotional voice has an immediate contagious effect on the listener. Antony also teased the crowd with the will, holding off the reading of it to the end, knowing it would push people over the edge. Holding up the cloak, he made his imagery visceral. Perhaps you are not trying to whip a crowd into a frenzy. You just want to bring people over to your side. Choose your strategy and words carefully. You might think it's better to reason with people, explain your ideas, but it's hard for an audience to decide whether an argument is reasonable as they listen to you talk. They have to concentrate and listen closely, which requires great effort. People are easily distracted by other stimuli, and if they miss a part of your argument, they'll feel confused, intellectually inferior, and vaguely insecure. It is more persuasive to appeal to people's hearts than their heads. Everyone shares emotions, and no one feels inferior to a speaker who stirs up their feelings. The crowd bonds together, everyone contagiously experiencing the same emotions. Antony talked of Caesar as if he and the listeners were experiencing the murder from Caesar's point of view. What could be more provocative? Use such changes of perspective to make your listeners feel what you are saying. Orchestrate your effects. It's more effective to move from one emotion to another than to just hit one note. The contrast between Antony's affection for Caesar and his indignation at the murderers was much more powerful than if he had stayed with one feeling or the other. The emotions you're trying to arouse should be strong ones. Don't speak of friendship and disagreement. Speak of love and hate. And it's crucial to try to feel something of the emotions you're trying to elicit. You will be more believable that way. This shouldn't be difficult. Imagine the reasons for loving or hating before you speak. If necessary, think of something from your past that fills you with rage. Emotions are contagious. It's easier to make someone cry if you're crying yourself. Make your voice an instrument and train it to communicate emotion. Learn to seem sincere. Napoleon studied the greatest actors of his time, and when he was alone, he would practice putting emotion into his voice. The goal of seductive speech is often to create a kind of hypnosis. You are distracting people, lowering their defenses, making them more vulnerable to suggestion. Learn the hypnotist's lessons of repetition and affirmation, key elements in putting a subject to sleep. Repetition involves using the same words over and over, preferably a word with emotional context. Taxes, liberals, bigots. The effect is mesmerizing. Ideas can be permanently implanted in people's unconscious simply by being repeated often enough. Affirmation is simply the making of strong, positive statements, like the hypnotist's commands. Seductive language should have a kind of boldness, which will cover up a multitude of sins. Your audience will be so caught up in your bold language that they won't have time to reflect on whether or not it's true. Never say, "I don't think the other side made a wise decision." Say, "We deserve better." Or, "They have made a mess of things." Affirmative language is active language, full of verbs, imperatives, and short sentences. Cut out, "I believe," "perhaps," "in my opinion." Head straight for the heart. You are learning to speak a different kind of language. Most people employ symbolic language. Their words stand for something real, the feelings, ideas, and beliefs they really have, or they stand for concrete things in the real world. The origin of the word symbolic lies in a Greek word meaning to bring things together, in this case, a word and something real. As a seducer, you are using the opposite, diabolic language. Your words do not stand for anything real. Their sound and the feelings they evoke are more important than what they are supposed to stand for. The word diabolic ultimately means to separate, to throw things apart. Here, words and reality. The more you make people focus on your sweet-sounding language and on the illusions and fantasies it conjures, the more you diminish their contact with reality. You lead them into the clouds, where it's hard to distinguish truth from untruth, real from unreal. Keep your words vague and ambiguous, so people are never quite sure what you mean. Envelop them in demonic, diabolical language, and they will not be able to focus on your maneuvers, on the possible consequences of your seduction. And the more they lose themselves in illusion, the easier it will be to lead them astray and seduce them. Reversal. Don't confuse flowery language with seduction. In using flowery language, you run the risk of wearing on people's nerves, of seeming pretentious. Excess verbiage is a sign of selfishness, of your inability to rein in your natural tendencies. Often with language, less is more. The elusive, vague, ambiguous phrase leaves the listener more room for imagination than does a sentence full of bombast and self-indulgence. You must always think first of your targets and of what will be pleasant to their ears. There will be many times when silence is best. What you do not say can be suggestive and eloquent, making you seem mysterious. In the 11th century Japanese court diary, the pillow book of Sei Shonagon, the counselor, Yoshichika, is intrigued by a lady he sees in a carriage, silent and beautiful. He sends her a note, and she sends one back. He is the only one to read it, but by his reaction, everyone can tell it is in bad taste or badly written. It spoils the effect of her beauty. Shonagon writes, quote, "I have heard people suggest that no reply at all is better than a bad one." Unquote. If you are not eloquent, if you cannot master seductive language, at least learn to curb your tongue. Use silence to cultivate an enigmatic presence. Finally, seduction has a pace and rhythm. In phase one, you're cautious and indirect. It's often best to disguise your intentions, to put your target at ease with deliberately neutral words. Your conversation should be harmless, even a bit bland. In this second phase, you turn more to the attack. This is the time for seductive language. Now, when you envelop them in your seductive words and letters, it comes as a pleasant surprise. It gives them the immensely pleasing feeling that they are the ones to suddenly inspire you with such poetry and intoxicating words. Chapter 11. Pay attention to detail. Lofty words and grand gestures can be suspicious. Why are you trying so hard to please? The details of a seduction, the subtle gestures, the offhand things you do, are often more charming and revealing. You must learn to distract your victims with a myriad of pleasant little rituals, thoughtful gifts tailored just for them, clothes and adornments designed to please them, gestures that show the time and attention you are paying them. All of their senses are engaged in the details you orchestrate. Create spectacles to dazzle their eyes. Mesmerized by what they see, they will not notice what you are really up to. Learn to suggest the proper feelings and moods through details. The mesmerizing effect. In December 1898, the wives of the 7 major Western ambassadors to China received a strange invitation. The 63-year-old Empress Dowager Cu Xi was hosting a banquet in their honor in the Forbidden City in Beijing. The ambassadors themselves had been quite displeased with the Empress Dowager for several reasons. Xi was a Manchu, a race of northerners who had conquered China in the early 17th century, establishing the Qing Dynasty and ruling the country for nearly 300 years. By the 1890s, the Western powers had begun to carve up parts of China, a country they considered backward. They wanted China to modernize, but the Manchus were conservative and resisted all reform. Earlier in 1898, the Chinese Emperor Guangxu, the Empress Dowager's 27-year-old nephew, had actually begun a series of reforms with the blessings of the West. Then, 100 days into this period of reform, word reached the Western diplomats from the Forbidden City that the Emperor was quite ill, and that the Empress Dowager had taken power. They suspected foul play. The Empress had probably acted to stop the reforms. The Emperor was being mistreated, probably poisoned. Perhaps he was already dead. When the 7 ambassadors' wives were preparing for their unusual visit, their husbands warned them, "Do not trust the Empress Dowager." A wily woman with a cruel streak, she had risen from obscurity to become the concubine of a previous emperor and had managed over the years to accumulate great power. Far more than the emperor, she was the most feared person in China. On the appointed day, the women were borne into the Forbidden City in a procession of sedan chairs carried by court eunuchs in dazzling uniforms. The women themselves, not to be outdone, wore the latest Western fashions. Tight corsets, long velvet dresses with leg of mutton sleeves, billowing petticoats, tall plumed hats. The residents of the Forbidden City looked at their clothes in amazement, and particularly at the way their dresses displayed their prominent bosoms. The wives felt sure they had impressed their hosts. At the audience hall, they were greeted by princes and princesses, as well as lower royalty. The Chinese women were wearing magnificent Manchu costumes with the traditional high, jewel-encrusted black headdresses. They were arranged in a hierarchical order reflected in the color of their dresses, an astounding rainbow of color. The wives were served tea in the most delicate porcelain cups, then were escorted into the presence of the Empress Dowager. The sight took their breath away. The Empress was seated on the dragon throne, which was studded with jewels. She wore heavily brocaded robes, a magnificent headdress bearing diamonds, pearls, and jade, and an enormous necklace of perfectly matched pearls. She was a tiny woman, but on the throne, in that dress, she seemed a giant. She smiled at the ladies with much warmth and sincerity. To their relief, seated below her on a smaller throne, was her nephew, the Emperor. He looked pale, but he greeted them enthusiastically and seemed in good spirits. Maybe he was, indeed, simply ill. The Empress shook the hand of each of the women. As she did so, an attendant eunuch handed her a large gold ring set with a large pearl, which she slipped onto each woman's hand. After this introduction, the wives were escorted into another room, where they again took tea, and then were led into a banqueting hall, where the Empress now sat on a chair of yellow satin, yellow being the imperial color. She spoke to them for a while. She had a beautiful voice. It was said that her voice could literally charm birds out of trees. At the end of the conversation, she took the hand of each woman again, and with much emotion told them, "One family. All one family." The women then saw a performance in the Imperial Theater. Finally, the Empress received them one last time. She apologized for the performance they had just seen, which was certainly inferior to what they were used to in the West. There was one more round of tea, and this time, as the wife of the American ambassador reported it, the Empress, quote, "stepped forward and tipped each cup of tea to her own lips and took a sip, then lifted the cup on the other side to our lips and said again, 'One family, all one family.'" The women were given more gifts, then were escorted back to their sedan chairs and borne out of the Forbidden City. The women relayed to their husbands their earnest belief that they had all been wrong about the Empress. The American ambassador's wife reported, quote, "She was bright and happy, and her face glowed with goodwill. There was no trace of cruelty to be seen. Her actions were full of freedom and warmth. We left full of admiration for Her Majesty and hopes for China." The husbands reported back to their governments the emperor was fine, and the empress could be trusted. Interpretation. The foreign contingent in China had no idea what was really happening in the Forbidden City. In truth, the emperor had conspired to arrest and possibly murder his aunt. Discovering the plot, a terrible crime in Confucian terms, she forced him to sign his own abdication, had him confined, and told the outside world that he was ill. As part of his punishment, he was to appear at state functions and act as if nothing had happened. The Empress Dowager loathed Westerners, whom she considered barbarians. She disliked the ambassador's wives, with their ugly fashions and simpering ways. The banquet was a show, a seduction, to appease the Western powers, which had been threatening invasion if the emperor had been killed. The goal of the seduction was simple: dazzle the wives with color, spectacle, theater. The Empress applied all her expertise to the task, and she was a genius for detail. She had designed the spectacles in a rising order. The uniformed eunuchs first, then the Manchu ladies in their headdresses, and finally the Empress herself. It was pure theater, and it was overwhelming. Then the Empress brought the spectacle down a notch, humanizing it with gifts, warm greetings, the reassuring presence of the Emperor, teas and entertainments which were in no way inferior to anything in the West. She ended the banquet on another high note, the little drama with the sharing of the teacups followed by even more magnificent gifts. The women's heads were spinning when they left. In truth, they had never seen such exotic splendor, and they never understood how carefully its details had been orchestrated by the Empress. Charmed by the spectacle, they transferred their happy feelings to the Empress and gave her their approval, all that she required. The key to distracting people, seduction is distraction, is to fill their eyes and ears with details, little rituals, colorful objects. Detail is what makes things seem real and substantial. A thoughtful gift won't seem to have an ulterior motive. A ritual full of charming little actions is so enjoyable to watch. Jewelry, handsome furnishings, touches of color and clothing dazzle the eye. It is a childish weakness of ours. We prefer to focus on the pleasant little details rather than on the larger picture. The more senses you appeal to, the more mesmerizing the effect. The objects you use in your seduction, gifts, clothes, etc., speak their own language, and it is a powerful one. Never ignore a detail or leave one to chance. Orchestrate them into a spectacle, and no one will notice how manipulative you're being. The sensuous effect. One day, a messenger told Prince Genji, the aging but still consummate seducer in the Heian court of late 10th century Japan, that one of his youthful conquests had suddenly died, leaving behind an orphan, a young woman named Tamakazura. Genji was not Tamakazura's father, but he decided to bring her to court and be her protector anyway. Soon after her arrival, men of the highest rank began to woo her. Genji had told everyone she was a lost daughter of his. As a result, they assumed that she was beautiful, for Genji was the handsomest man in the court. At the time, men rarely saw a young girl's face before marriage. In theory, they were allowed to talk to her only if she was on the other side of a screen. Genji showered her with attention, helping her sort through all the love letters she was receiving and advising her on the right match. As Tamakazura's protector, Genji was able to see her face, and she was indeed beautiful. He fell in love with her. What a shame, he thought, to give this lovely creature away to another man. One night, overwhelmed by her charms, he held her hand and told her how much she resembled her mother, whom he once had loved. She trembled, not with excitement, however, but with fear, for although he wasn't her father, he was supposed to be her protector, not a suitor. Her attendants were away, and it was a beautiful night. Genji silently threw off his perfumed robe and pulled her down beside him. She began to cry and to resist. Always a gentleman, Genji told her that he would respect her wishes, he would always care for her, and she had nothing to fear. He then politely excused himself. Several days later, Genji was helping Tamakazura with her correspondence when he read a love letter from his younger brother, Prince Hotaru, who numbered among her suitors. In the letter, Hotaru berated Tamakazura for not letting him get physically close enough to talk to her and tell her his feelings. Tamakazura had not replied. Unused to the manners of the court, she had felt shy and intimidated. As if to help her, Genji got one of his servants to write to Hotaru in her name. The letter, written on beautiful perfumed paper, warmly invited the prince to visit her. Hotaru appeared at the appointed hour. He smelled a beguiling incense, mysterious and seductive. Mixed into this scent was Genji's own perfume. The prince felt a wave of excitement. Approaching the screen behind which Tamakazura sat, he confessed his love for her. Without making a sound, she retreated to another screen, farther away. Suddenly, there was a flash of light as if a torch had flared up, and Hotaru saw her profile behind the screen. She was more beautiful than he had imagined. Two things delighted the prince: the sudden, mysterious flash of light, and the brief glimpse of his beloved. Now he was truly in love. Hotaru began to court her assiduously. Meanwhile, feeling reassured that Genji was no longer chasing her, Tamakazura saw her protector more often. And now she couldn't help noticing little details. Genji's robes seemed to glow in pleasing and vibrant colors, as if dyed by unworldly hands. Hotaru's robes seemed drab by comparison, and the perfumes burned into Genji's garments, how intoxicating they were. No one else bore such a scent. Hotaru's letters were polite and well-written, but the letters Genji sent her were on magnificent paper, perfumed and dyed, and they quoted lines of poetry, always surprising yet always appropriate for the occasion. Genji also grew and gathered flowers, wild carnations, for instance, that he gave as gifts and that seemed to symbolize his unique charm. One evening, Genji proposed to teach Tamakazura how to play the koto. She was delighted. She loved to read romance novels, and whenever Genji played the koto, she felt as if she were transported into one of her books. No one played the instrument better than Genji. She would be honored to learn from him. Now, he saw her often, and the method of his lessons was simple. She would choose a song for him to play, and then would try to imitate him. After they played, they would lie down side by side, their heads resting on the koto, staring up at the moon. Genji would have torches set up in the garden, giving the view the softest glow. The more Tamakazura saw of the court, of Prince Hotaru, the other suitors, the emperor himself, the more she realized that none could compare to Genji. He was supposed to be her protector. Yes, that was still true, but was it such a sin to fall in love with him? Confused, she found herself giving in to the caresses and kisses that he began to surprise her with, now that she was too weak to resist. Interpretation. Genji is the protagonist in the 11th century novel, The Tale of Genji, written by Murasaki Shikibu, a woman of the Heian court. The character was most likely inspired by the real-life seducer Fujiwara no Korechika. In his seduction of Tamakazura, Genji's strategy was simple. He would make her realize indirectly how charming and irresistible he was by surrounding her with unspoken details. He also brought her in contact with his brother. Comparison with this drab, stiff figure would make Genji's superiority clear. The night Hotaru first visited her, Genji set everything up, as if to support Hotaru's seducing, the mysterious scent, then the flash of light by the screen. The light came from a novel effect. Earlier in the evening, Genji had collected hundreds of fireflies in a cloth bag. At the proper moment, he let them all go at once. But when Tamakazura saw Genji encouraging Hotaru's pursuit of her, her defenses against her protector relaxed, allowing her senses to be filled by this master of seductive effects. Genji orchestrated every possible detail: the scented paper, the colored robes, the lights in the garden, the wild carnations, the apt poetry, the koto lessons, which induced an irresistible feeling of harmony. Tamakazura found herself dragged into a sensual whirlpool. Bypassing the shyness and mistrust that words or actions would only have worsened, Genji surrounded his ward with objects, sights, sounds, and scents that symbolized the pleasure of his company far more than his actual physical presence would have. In fact, his presence could only have been threatening. He knew that a young girl's senses are her most vulnerable point. The key to Genji's masterful orchestration of detail was his attention to the target of his seduction. Like Genji, you must attune your own senses to your targets, watching them carefully, adapting to their moods. You sense when they are defensive and retreat. You also sense when they are giving in and move forward. In between, The details you set up, gifts, entertainments, the clothes you wear, the flowers you choose, are aimed precisely at their tastes and predilections. Genji knew he was dealing with a young girl who loved romantic novels. His wild flowers, koto playing, and poetry brought their world to life for her. Attend to your target's every move and desire, and reveal your attentiveness in the details and objects you surround them with, filling their senses with the mood you need to inspire. They can argue with your words, but not with the effect you have on their senses. Keys to Seduction. When we were children, our senses were much more active. The colors of a new toy or a spectacle such as a circus held us in thrall. A smell or a sound could fascinate us. In the games we created, many of them reproducing something in the adult world on a smaller scale, what pleasure we took in orchestrating every detail. We noticed everything. As we grow older, our senses get dulled. We no longer notice as much, for we are constantly hurrying to get things done, to move on to the next task. In seduction, you're always trying to bring the target back to the golden moments of childhood. A child is less rational, more easily deceived. A child is also more attuned to the pleasures of the senses. So when your targets are with you, you must never give them the feeling they normally get in the real world, where we are all rushed, ruthless, out for ourselves. You need to deliberately slow things down and return them to the simpler times of their youth. The details that you orchestrate, colors, gifts, little ceremonies, are aimed at their senses, at the childish delight we take in the immediate charms of the natural world. Their senses, filled with delightful things, they grow less capable of reason and rationality. Pay attention to detail, and you will find yourself assuming a slower pace. Your targets will not focus on what you might be after, sexual favors, power, etc., because you seem so considerate, so attentive. In the childish realm of the senses in which you envelop them, they get a clear sense that you are involving them in something distinct from the real world, an essential ingredient of seduction. Remember, the more you get people to focus on the little things, the less they will notice your larger direction. The seduction will assume the slow, hypnotic pace of a ritual in which the details have a heightened importance and the moments are full of ceremony. In 8th century China, Emperor Ming Huang caught a glimpse of a beautiful young woman combing her hair beside an imperial pool. Her name was Yang Guifei, and even though she was the concubine of the emperor's son, he had to have her for himself. Since he was emperor, nobody could stop him. The emperor was a practical man. He had many concubines, and they all had their charms, but he had never lost his head over a woman. Yang Guifei, though, was different. Her body exuded the most wonderful fragrance. She wore gowns made of the sheerest silk gauze, each embroidered with different flowers, depending on the season. In walking, she seemed to float, her tiny steps invisible beneath her gown. She danced to perfection, wrote songs in his honor that she sang magnificently, had a way of looking at him that made his blood boil with desire. She quickly became his favorite. Yang Guifei drove the emperor to distraction. He built palaces for her, spent all his time with her, satisfied her every whim. Before long, his kingdom was bankrupt and ruined. Yang Guifei was an artful seductress who had a devastating effect on all the men who crossed her path. There were so many ways her presence charmed. The scents, the voice, the movements, the witty conversation, the artful glances, the embroidered gowns. These pleasurable details turned a mighty king into a distracted baby. Since time immemorial, women have known that within the most apparently self-possessed man is an animal whom they can lead by filling his senses with the proper physical lures. The key is to attack on as many fronts as possible. Do not ignore your voice, your gestures, your walk, your clothes, your glances. Some of the most alluring women in history have so distracted their victims with sensual detail that the men fail to notice it is all an illusion. From the 1940s on into the early 1960s, Pamela Churchill Harriman had a series of affairs with some of the most prominent and wealthy men in the world. Averell Harriman, whom years later she married, Gianni Agnelli, heir to the Fiat fortune, Baron Ailey de Rothschild. What attracted these men and kept them enthralled was not her beauty or her lineage or her vivacious personality, but her extraordinary attention to detail. It began with her attentive look as she listened to your every word, soaking up your tastes. Once she found her way into your home, she would fill it with your favorite flowers, get your chef to cook that dish you had tasted only in the finest restaurants. You mentioned an artist you liked. A few days later, that artist would be attending one of your parties. She found the perfect antiques for you, dressed in the way that most pleased or excited you, and she did this without your saying a word. She spied, gathered information from third parties, overheard you talking to someone else. Harriman's attention to detail had an intoxicating effect on all the men in her life. It had something in common with the pampering of a mother, there to bring order and comfort into their lives, attending to their needs. Life is harsh and competitive. Attending to detail in a way that is soothing to the other person makes them dependent upon you. The key is probing their needs in a way that is not too obvious, so that when you make precisely the right gesture, it seems uncanny, as if you had read their mind. This is another way of returning your targets to childhood, when all of their needs were met. In the eyes of women all over the world, Rudolf Valentino reigned as the great lover through much of the 1920s. The qualities behind his appeal certainly included his handsome, almost pretty face, his dancing skills, the strangely exciting streak of cruelty in his manner, but his perhaps most endearing trait was his time-consuming approach to courtship. His films would show him seducing a woman slowly, with careful details, sending her flowers, choosing the variety to match the mood he wanted to induce, taking her hand, lighting her cigarette, escorting her to romantic places, leading her on the dance floor. These were silent movies, and his audiences never got to hear him speak. It was all in his gestures. Men came to hate him, for their wives and girlfriends now expected the slow, careful Valentino treatment. Valentino had a feminine streak. It was said that he wooed a woman the way another woman would. But femininity need not figure in this approach to seduction. In the early 1770s, Prince Grigori Potemkin began an affair with Empress Catherine the Great of Russia that was to last many years. Potemkin was a manly man, and not at all handsome, but he managed to win the Empress's heart by the many little things he did, and continued to do, long after the affair had begun. He spoiled her with wonderful gifts, never tired of writing her long letters, arranged for all kinds of entertainments for her, composed songs to her beauty. Yet he would appear before her barefoot, hair uncombed, clothes wrinkled. There was no kind of fussiness in his attention, which, however, did make it clear he would go to the ends of the earth for her. A woman's senses are more refined than a man's. To a woman, Yang Kuei-fei's overt sensual appeal would seem too hurried and direct. What that means, though, is that all the man really has to do is take it slowly, making seduction a ritual full of all kinds of little things he has to do for his target. If he takes his time, he will have her eating out of his hand. Everything in seduction is a sign, and nothing more so than clothes. It's not that you have to dress interestingly, elegantly, or provocatively, but that you have to dress for your target, have to appeal to your target's tastes. When Cleopatra was seducing Mark Antony, her dress was not brazenly sexual. She dressed as a Greek goddess, knowing his weakness for such fantasy figures. Madame de Pompadour, the mistress of King Louis XV, knew the king's weaknesses. his chronic boredom. She constantly wore different clothes, changing not only their color but their style, supplying the king with a constant feast for his eyes. Pamela Harriman was subdued in the fashions she wore, befitting her role as a high-society geisha and reflecting the sober tastes of the men she seduced. Contrast works well here. At work or at home, you might dress nonchalantly. Marilyn Monroe, for example, wore jeans and a t-shirt at home. But when you're with a target, you wear something elaborate, as if you were putting on a costume. Your Cinderella transformation will stir excitement and the feeling that you have done something just for the person you are with. Whenever your attention is individualized, you wouldn't dress like that for anyone else. It is infinitely more seductive. In the 1870s, Queen Victoria found herself wooed by Benjamin Disraeli, her own prime minister. Disraeli's words were flattering and his manner insinuating. He also sent her flowers, valentines, gifts, but not just any flowers or gifts, the kind that most men would send. The flowers were primroses, symbols of their simple yet beautiful friendship. From then on, whenever Victoria saw a primrose, she thought of Disraeli. Or he would write on a valentine that he, quote, no longer in the sunset, but the twilight of his existence must encounter a life of anxiety and toil. But this, too, has its romance when he remembers that he labors for the most gracious of beings, unquote. Or he might send her a little box with no inscription, but with a heart transfixed by an arrow on one side and the word fideliter, or faithfully, on the other. Victoria fell in love with Disraeli. A gift has immense seductive power, but the object itself is less important than the gesture and the subtle thought or emotion that it communicates. Perhaps the choice relates to something from the target's past, or symbolizes something between you, or merely represents the lengths you will go to please. It wasn't the money Disraeli spent that impressed Victoria, but the time he took to find the appropriate thing or make the appropriate gesture. Expensive gifts have no sentiment attached. They may temporarily excite their recipient, but they're quickly forgotten, as a child forgets a new toy. The object that reflects its giver's attentiveness has a lingering sentimental power, which resurfaces every time its owner sees it. In 1919, the Italian writer and war hero Gabriele D'Annunzio managed to put together a band of followers and take over the town of Fiume on the Adriatic coast, now part of Slovenia. They established their own government there, which lasted for over a year. D'Annunzio initiated a series of public spectacles that were to be immensely influential on politicians elsewhere. He would address the public from a balcony overlooking the town's main square, which would be full of colorful banners, flags, pagan religious symbols, and at night, torches. The speeches would be followed by processions. Although D'Annunzio was not at all a fascist, what he did in Fiume crucially affected Benito Mussolini, who borrowed his Roman salutes, his use of symbols, his mode of public address. Spectacles like these have been used since then by governments everywhere, even democratic ones. Their overall impression may be grand, but it is the orchestrated details that make them work, the number of senses they appeal to, the variety of emotions they stir. You are aiming to distract people, and nothing is more distracting than a wealth of detail. Fireworks, flags, music, uniforms, marching soldiers, the feel of the crowd packed together. It becomes difficult to think straight, particularly if the symbols and details stir up patriotic emotions. Finally, words are important in seduction and have a great deal of power to confuse, distract, and boost the vanity of the target. But what is most seductive in the long run is what you do not say, what you communicate indirectly. Words come easily, and people distrust them. Anyone can say the right words, and once they are said, nothing is binding, and they may even be forgotten altogether. The gesture, the thoughtful gift, the little details seem much more real and substantial. They are also much more charming than lofty words about love, precisely because they speak for themselves and let the seduced read into them more than is there. Never tell someone what you are feeling. Let them guess it in your looks and gestures. That is a more convincing language. Reversal. There is no reversal. Details are essential to any successful seduction and cannot be ignored. Chapter 12. Poeticize your presence. Important things happen when your targets are alone. The slightest feeling of relief that you are not there, and it is all over. Familiarity and overexposure will cause this reaction. Remain elusive, then, so that when you're away, they will yearn to see you again and will associate you only with pleasant thoughts. Occupy their minds by alternating an exciting presence with a cool distance, exuberant moments followed by calculated absences. Associate yourself with poetic images and objects so that when they think of you, they begin to see you through an idealized halo. The more you figure in their minds, the more they will envelop you in seductive fantasies. Feed these fantasies by subtle inconsistencies and changes in your behavior. Poetic presence or absence. In 1943, the Argentine military overthrew the government. A popular 48-year-old colonel, Juan Perón, was named Secretary of Labor and Social Affairs. Perón was a widower who had a fondness for young girls. At the time of his appointment, he was involved with a teenager, whom he introduced to one and all as his daughter. One evening, in January of 1944, Perón was seated among the other military leaders in a Buenos Aires stadium, attending an artists' festival. It was late, and there were some empty seats around him. Out of nowhere, two beautiful young actresses asked his permission to sit down. Were they joking? He would be delighted. He recognized one of the actresses. It was Eva Duarte, a star of radio soap operas whose photograph was often on the covers of the tabloids. The other actress was younger and prettier, but Perón could not take his eyes off Eva, who was talking to another colonel. She was really not his type at all. She was 24, far too old for his taste. She was dressed rather garishly, and there was something a little icy in her manner. But she looked at him occasionally, and her glance excited him. He looked away for a moment, and the next thing he knew, she had changed seats and was sitting next to him. They started to talk. She hung on his every word. Yes, everything he said was precisely how she felt. The poor, the workers, they were the future of Argentina. She had known poverty herself. There were almost tears in her eyes when she said at the end of the conversation, "Thank you for existing." In the next few days, Eva managed to get rid of Perón's daughter and establish herself in his apartment. Everywhere he turned, there she was, fixing him meals, caring for him when he was ill, advising him on politics. Why did he let her stay? Usually, he would have a fling with a superficial young girl, then get rid of her when she seemed to be sticking around too much. But there was nothing superficial about Eva. As time went by, he found himself getting addicted to the feeling she gave him. She was intensely loyal, mirroring his every idea, puffing him up endlessly. He felt more masculine in her presence. That was it. And more powerful. She believed he would make the country's ideal leader, and her belief affected him. She was like the women in the tango ballads he loved so much, the suffering women of the streets who became saintly mother figures and looked after their men. Perón saw her every day, but he never felt he fully knew her. One day, her comments were a little obscene. The next, she was the perfect lady. He had one worry. She was angling to get married, and he could never marry her. She was an actress with a dubious past. The other colonels were already scandalized by his involvement with her. Nevertheless, the affair went on. In 1945, Perón was dismissed from his post and jailed. The colonels feared his growing popularity and distrusted the power of his mistress, who seemed to have total influence over him. It was the first time in almost 2 years that he was truly alone and truly separated from Eva. Suddenly, he felt new emotions sweeping over him. He pinned her photographs all over the wall. Outside, massive strikes were being organized